I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Laura Lee Rosano is a family counselor at the Edgewood Treatment Center in Nanaimo, British Columbia. She joins me now to talk about a new novel she's just written, Jagged Little Edges. In the book, Lindsay is a teen living a troubled life. She's hurt by whatever family life she has, neglected, beaten. It's dysfunctional, to say the least. And there's addiction. Looking for love, she turns to drugs and alcohol and finds herself in an abusive relationship. I'll get Ms. Rosano to tell us about this book, why she wrote it, and how much of her own experiences inspired this story. The book is available as an e-book off of the Amazon and Barnes & Noble websites. And a tactile book will be available later in the year. The website for more is at jaggedledges.com. Please welcome to the Plant Health Line program, Laura Lee Rosano. Ms. Rosano, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. It's great to be with you this morning, and I'm so appreciative of the fact that we're covering this topic today.
It's an interesting one for me because I've been fascinated by addictions. I mean, I think I have an addiction of my own, and that's just buying too many books. And I don't mean to trivialize the subject of addictions, but it seems that it's something that's around us a lot, but we don't really know how to talk about it. Is that your experience?
It is my experience. You know, a really simple way to identify addiction is any life-altering, any mood-altering substance or behavior. So anything you do or anything you ingest that has life-damaging consequences. Would be a great description. So, for instance, if my addiction is books and it's getting in the way of I can't put the book down, I can't get to work on time, I can't get my kids out, I can't cook dinner, my marriage is falling apart because I can't stop reading and I'm not sleeping anymore and I'm reading all night, and then chances are that's a very apt description for addiction.
Is it a coincidence that Lindsay's name, the character in your book, starts with an L like yours?
Well, you know, probably not a coincidence. This book developed long before I wrote it. I liken addiction to the walking wounded. Most of us, and I'm a recovering addict myself, most of us that have this addiction disorder, first of all, we know almost always it's genetic. It runs in families like colors of hair and eye color. And so hopefully, you know, to your listeners, that helps a little bit, because so often families think, you know, maybe it was something they did or didn't do, and certainly environment plays a part, but genetics are huge. And I know that, you know, with this illness, there's something missing. It's like a hole, but the hole's invisible. Like you can't see it in people. But the person knows it's there, and often how they describe it is they feel just a little bit different than other people. And so they use things to fill that place of the hole, and sometimes it's relationships, sometimes it's drugs and alcohol, sometimes it's books and work and gambling, sex, eating, all sorts of things. But the problem is those things work for a little while, and then the hole then it wears off, the hole gets bigger, and the need to fill it increases, and eventually the hole doesn't fill, and that's when we get into real problems with addiction.
When you say that you've always felt a little different, does that go back, say, when you were a kid?
Yep, I remember this when I was a child, feeling like I was looking at the world from the outside in. I would be viewing the world, I felt excluded from it, though. And I know that sounds really strange, but it's like almost watching a movie. You're in it, but you're not. So it's a little bit like that. You feel there's a saying for those of us that work in addiction and have been to treatment centers. They call it terminally unique. You just feel different. Now, I know, you know, on the other side of recovery all these years later, that difference is lack of self-worth, lack of self-esteem, lack of emotional development. You know, most of us, when we start to use whatever that chronological age is, that's where we arrest emotionally. So when I use something like, I'll say, some marijuana, when I use marijuana to comfort me because I'm hurting emotionally, I stop growing emotionally. So if I start smoking pot at 13 and that's what I use to numb out my pain. I never developed the skill set to be the emotional age as I am physically. So, and that's why you see so many times when you deal with addiction, it's almost like there's a kid in that adult body. They're not behaving in an adult fashion. They're not emoting in an adult fashion. Working in rehab is a little bit like working in a high school. There's a real definition of behaviors going on, some bullying and some behaviors that you certainly healthy individuals, healthy adult individuals wouldn't be exhibiting. And this is a big symptom of this illness. Is again, like when you start using, obviously you don't grow up emotionally, and so you can imagine how that works as an adult.
Your experiences with addiction, has that informed the work that you do now as a counselor? And do you think that you're a better counselor because you've been through what you've been through?
Because
you've been there, like the addict. Yeah. You've been there, and you can empathize, I guess.
Yeah. I can empathize, but I can also know from my own experience, because you see, with addiction too, addiction is so multifaceted. I mean, it's the only disease out of all the diseases, and thank goodness in British Columbia, the physicians have deemed this an illness. We actually know it is. It's an illness with symptoms, a pathology, and it's very treatable. But it's the only illness that'll ever tell you don't have it. So it not only takes over the way you think, feel, behave, it takes over all your beliefs, and it kind of, it's almost like a puppet master. You dance to its tune, although you're so unaware. And it's very sincere. One of the biggest symptoms is delusion. It's very sincere. So when someone with addiction tells you they don't have a problem, it's very convincing because they actually believe that, in spite of all the mounting evidence. So our job in treatment is to constantly hold up the mirror. Hang on, that's delusion. That's your disease. That's not true. You do have a problem, and here's how it's showing in your life. And then you kind of feed them back. Now, if you don't have a really good education and support system for yourself, addiction will simply wear you out. It's very bullying. It's very defensive. It's very minimizing and blaming, resentful. And so most folks aren't particularly comfortable around that behavior. So I think my own self in being in recovery and understanding my process has very much helped me in the field I work in, for sure.
How bad was it for you? How bad did it get for you?
It got really bad. It got really bad. So many times along the ways, I mean, when my children were little, here's a great description. I worked in bars for years. Now, I like to say to everybody, I've been working in addiction all my life, and yeah, in a way I have. I used to, I used to help people get loaded, now I sober them up. But it got really bad. There was moments when my kids were growing up where I had eye blinks of reality, and those are the most treatable moments, by the way, where I would lay the next morning, the night before, I'd be putting my makeup on, and my daughter knew I had an illness far before I ever did. She'd act up and get, pulling on me and say, "Mommy, please don't go out," and I'd look at her very convincingly, because I believe this, and say, "Don't worry, I'm just going out for a couple, I'll be right home." And then I'd get a little annoyed because she'd keep amping up, and I think, geez, what a little brat, Yeah. She doesn't need to do that. In my mind, I was telling the truth. I really was. I didn't understand. I'd lost the ability to accurately predict what would happen when I'd taken the first drink. I might come home, but chances were greater I wouldn't. So somehow I remember the rising of the sun and the birds singing and the horror and shame that would engulf me as I'd make my way home, creeping through the house, trying not to wake anyone up, and just horrified. How had this happened again? Because when I told my daughter the night before, I absolutely 100% meant it. And so it was in those hours of realization and horror and shame and guilt and remorse that an addict or an alcoholic is the most keen to get help. Now, what happens is you go to sleep, you get up, you're on your best behavior, you make it up to everybody in your world, and pretty soon, within 3 days, you know what? You're right back at it. You're convinced everything's better, I'll never do that again, I won't drink wine, next time I'll only have beer, and away you go again. And at some point, you cross a threshold where you now realize you've become everything you've ever loathed, and that hurts so bad, you start using to oblivion, and then it becomes dangerous.
And so for you, it was booze. Was it anything else?
Yeah, it was booze and drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then at the age of 37, you called your parents for help. You tell your dad, I'm ready.
Yeah.
Before that, he doesn't believe you, I guess, or he's skeptical.
Well, and so he should be. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I mean this with the most respect, and I'm going to say it because I'm a recovering addict, but how do you know someone that's active in addiction is lying? Because their lips are moving.
Mm.
And I mean that with the most love and respect. If I hope I'm not offending any of your viewers, but it's the truth. And the problem with this illness is it takes away your ability to have truth and replaces it with so many, you know, dishonesty and denial and minimizing, you know, that kind of thing. So my family had very rightly pushed me out of their life. And I had resented them for that. And now when you're active in your addiction, it looks for things to feast and feed on. And so it took all that resentment and just, you know, really made it even more right that I was using. Of course you'd be drinking if you had families like mine. You know, can you believe these type of people? And so it would, addiction focuses on everything wrong, and it lives in self-pity. That poor me, poor me, poor me another, right? And so that's where it'll always go. It lives in unmanageability and chaos and poor me's. It doesn't have the ability to look at the most profound things, you know, like fingers and toes and our children and how incredibly blessed we are just to even be here. So it kind of views life through that lens.
So when you say I'm ready, that's the key, I guess. I mean, someone else can't force you to go into treatment. A judge can't. You have to be ready, right?
Well, here's the thing. I said I'm ready because I had no other option. Honestly, thank God my family and friends played hardball with me. Honestly, I'd be dead. I would. I was so sick at the end. I really believed my justification and rationalization. So here's what happened. My family didn't talk to me. I got fired from my job. My boyfriend, who's now my husband, left me. I literally had nowhere to go. One of the very last memories of my using is I was actually out on the street. I slept under a cement ramp. And it was those consequences that really made me go, oh, my God, seriously, I've got to go. And I went to treatment because I didn't have anywhere else to go. I had absolutely nowhere else to go. When I went to treatment, I brought my matching luggage, my Save-On overweighty garbage little bags, food bags, because I had literally nothing. And I had enough clothes to last a couple days. And in my mind, I was going to go in, because I'd always been able to do this before, and convince people there was absolutely nothing wrong with me, and my family needed to smarten up, and if they would smarten up, we'd all be very happy. And I'd get my family back, and my boyfriend would come back, and we could all go back to the way we were living. I could go back working in another bar. And for the very first time in my life, somebody didn't buy my story, which was awesome. It's exactly what I needed. Thank goodness, you know, and of course, you know, anyone active in addiction doesn't appreciate that at the moment, and it was difficult, it was challenging, and those were the scariest steps in my life I've ever taken, those two steps across that threshold, because, you know, Joseph, I was leaving my best friend on the other side, the thing that had always made me feel better and equal and same as, you know?
Yeah, you say that, that addiction was your greatest love.
It was.
Yeah, and can you unpack that for people listening who might not understand what that means?
Well, here's the thing. I didn't know it then either. I would have told you my greatest love was my parents or my family. I certainly would have told you my greatest love was my children. That was my belief. That's how sick and delusional I was. Here's how we look at what your greatest love really is. It's not by what you say. It's by what you do. And when I look back at what I did, I put my addiction before my family every single time. As a matter of fact, I planned my life around where the next drink was. I didn't like going to things that didn't include alcohol. That wasn't quote-unquote fun.
Yeah.
So I can tell you I loved my family, but the truth is I put my addiction before it. So my addiction was my greatest love, and that's not a difficult thing for me to admit now because my greatest love is my family. And those aren't words today. Those are actions.
And so you're a recovering addict. now.
Yeah.
What's the day-to-day like? I mean, is it, as they say, one day at a time?
You know, it used to be. I'm really, really, really lucky. I worked really hard in treatment. I went to meetings. I went to aftercare. I followed suggestions. I didn't test my thinking. I did the next right thing and let someone else with more experience in sobriety tell me how to live, and I just followed along. So I got well in spite of myself, and I mean that earnestly. Very, very early in recovery, somewhere within that first year, I was really lucky. The desire to drink and drug was removed, but in its place, a desire to live and live in a way that I'd never known before was there. So, you know, I love being able to help others understand the purpose of addiction, because I do believe it's a gift. I really do. It's strange as that may seem, I don't think I'd ever know how to live this way without my addiction. Never. I don't think that the sound of birds chirps in the morning could expand a heart to the size that tears have to flow, because there's just such joy in hearing it. Like, I don't think I ever would have lived this way, this contented and this joyful, without addiction. And so I really, you know, Ernest Hemingway says it best, we are stronger in our broken places. And I believe that lock, stock, and barrel. So I really try to help other people find that place in them. I'm a fantastic mother now. I'm a grandmother, and I've seen my grandchildren born taking their first breaths, and they've never seen me take a drink. And so you just have to find something to fill that place that drugs and alcohol used to be in. And when you find that, it isn't a struggle anymore. It's an absolute joy.
Is there something that you know now that you wish you knew then? That maybe could have prevented all of this from happening? Or, I mean, as you say, it's a gift, so maybe you had to go through it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots I know now that I wished I would have known then. I wished I would have known then how precious I was. And I wished I would have known then how unique I was, and I don't mean that terminally unique place. And I wished I would have known then that I was good enough and worthy of all things good, and that I didn't have to compete with girlfriends. I wish I would have known that you can really trust people, and I wish I would have known that it's okay to hurt. You don't die from it. It's uncomfortable, but you grow from it. It's okay. There's lots of things I wished I would have known then, but then maybe not, you know, because I know them now, and I can help other people know them. I'm always amazed, Joseph, at how much as a society we wear these masks, you know, and we cover up our true selves as if somehow exposing them would be a shameful secret. I just having talks with people on a real, honest, emoting level, so many are afraid to really express their needs and what they want and fears and ideas and things like that. And for me, relationships are all about the ability to do that. You know, that into me you see. Of course, we have to be in a safe relationship to do that, I suppose. But, you know, there's lots of things I perhaps wish I would have known. But the really cool thing is I regret nothing.
Yeah.
I regret nothing. Well, that's not true. I regret one thing. I regret that my children never got the mother they deserved when they were little. Because every child deserves an emotionally healthy parent whose face lights up when they walk in the room, who develops those pathways in the brain that are so necessary when we're little, you know, like when you're held and cuddled and your fingers and toes are played with and you're cooed at, and there's something that stimulates in the pathways of your brain and for really development of emotional health. So I regret that I was there for my kids. My physical body was there. My emotional body, my spiritual body, those bodies of me was missing. We need more than physical presence in our lives.
Do you enjoy writing this book?
I did. I really did. I am... I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it in every which way. There was difficult moments in this book for me to write. It was very... It was a very, very healing for me to write in a way. You know, there was tears in this book. There was laughter in this book. There was power in this book. I thought I was writing one book, and about two-thirds of the way through, I realized, oh, my gosh, I can't do it in one book. There's there's so much more with this. So, and then at the end of the book, I realized, oh dear, two books won't do it either. So it turned into a series of three. But I'm really excited. I mean, this Lindsay, the character in this book, she could be your best friend, she could be your wife, your sister, your daughter, your lover. She could be you. I mean, there's lots to relate to, whether you have a disease or not. Just in it, she shows a real clear picture of how she's feeling and thinking. So,
what were you able to do in fiction that you couldn't have done, say, if you were writing a memoir? I'm assuming that there's a reason why you wrote this as a novel. I mean, you could have easily written a memoir, right?
I could have written a memoir, but I'll tell you what, I really wanted to be respectful of my family. I really wanted to be respectful of my children, of my ex-husband, of the place I work. I work in treatment. And I know in no way wanted to indicate, you know, this would be about any of the folks there. So there was many, many reasons. I did, you know, it's funny you asked that question because I really fought with that one. I know just from a sales perspective, anything that's a memoir is going to be a lot more successful. But this, for me, wasn't about dollars and cents. And it wasn't about success that way. It was just about something that needed to be wrote in the most respectful, protective manner I could. And, you know, I wrote a little book with my granddaughter, Gracie's Secret, and it's been picked up by a few places that work with kids that have, you know, lived in difficult situations. Writing for me has never been about so much the monetary value. It's been more about when someone says, oh my God, Laura Lee, I can so relate. That's how I felt. I didn't even think of it in this perspective. You know, when someone's eye has been really clouded with despair and hopelessness, mm-hmm. and for a moment there's light back in that eye, that's why I write. That's why I write. That's my purpose these days. And so it's more about that.
And do you have an idea, while you're writing the book, who should read it? Like, do you have someone in mind that ought to pick it up because they can find clarity, they can find wisdom in it?
Well, I think anyone that's ever struggled with addiction, whether that's your own self or a family member, would definitely find something out of it. I think teenage girls need to read this book. You know, as a teenage girl, I remember when I was 16, oh my gosh, Joseph, it was so, you'd almost die if you broke up with a boyfriend, or, you know, you'd seriously, and your hormones are all over the place, and you believe, you're very naive at 16, you're not world experienced whatsoever, you're very gullible, you'll go along with things that aren't in your best interest sexually and all sorts of other ways. So, I'd love for teens to read it. I think that would be very valuable to them, too, female and males, perhaps. The second book that I'm writing, for family members, this is a must. This encompasses really how families end up protecting and enabling the disease of addiction, and they don't even know it. So, more towards them on the second book.
In terms of the addictions that our society suffers from, and I'm asking this because you're a counselor and you see addicts, I guess, at the front line, if you will, are you seeing a lot of one kind of addiction versus another?
You know, it seems to go in waves. For a little while back, it was OxyContin was huge. It's not so easy to get. The heroin's on the increase. For when I went to treatment back in 1997, almost always it was alcohol. We're seeing younger and younger and younger folks now. There's a lot of these head shops popping up and drugs like spice and things like this, bath salts. So there's a lot of prescription medications now that are a problem. We actually do, I work in a treatment center, Edgewood, we do physician training. We've actually got a program going right now, and it's interesting. It's really interesting actually watching the doctors in those programs and what they gain from going through the treatment experience just to go back into their own communities and work with their patients, because prescription medications is hugely on the rise. You know, I think addiction is really a spiritual malady. It's there's something missing. There's a void. And again, you know, we look for ways to numb out, and computers are a great way to do that with these days too. So, yeah, I don't know if it's because I work in it, and really since my first breath, it seems like addiction has followed me, and I'm not kidding. I'm not, so I may be viewing it out of that type of really hypervigilant lens, but to me, it seems like it is on the rise.
And I guess on the rise as well are these misconceptions that people have about addictions.
Yes, it's so many, and it's frustrating because, you know, we come bump up against this harm reduction versus abstinent-based. Well, I can tell you I'm 100% abstinent-based. That's my theory, that's my belief, that's my experience, that's what works. And so we have a whole, not only family system enabling addiction, we have societal, communal, and political, you know, places enabling addiction too. You know, so many folks on welfare have not, you know, they're not just in trouble financially, they're in trouble with addictions and just life skills and things like that. So it's so treatable, and yet it's so big. And I think oftentimes we have folks in place that make decisions to treat addiction or what needs to happen, but they perhaps don't have the doctorate in the addiction, or they don't have the understanding or experience actually working in it. So, you know, we're all, I think, as a society, we do our best, but really our best isn't good enough. It isn't. And we need to start looking at it and doing things differently and opening up the doors and having these conversations and not putting our head in the sand pretending it doesn't exist, because it does exist. It's everywhere. And, you know, and these aren't bad folks or sick folks. And I think that's really a very important difference.
Laurie, this has been a fascinating conversation today. Congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Well, thank you so much, Joseph, for having me and having this conversation.
And you're welcome when the next book comes out, certainly.
Love to, absolutely.
The website for more, jaggedlittleedges.com. The book is called Jagged Little Edges. Its author, Laurie Rosano, on the line from Nanaimo in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponto.